Welcome everyone to another episode of RTS Masterminds. It's been a while, but we've come back from the undead, I guess. So with me, I've got Vapor Strategy, Brandon Castile, lead designer on Tempest Rising.
Hey everybody, how's it going? Good to be back.
Oh yeah.
And all right.
I'm Nakamura, Valent Martin, whatever you prefer. I'm the lead systems designer on Titan Quest II at Grimlore Games. In the past, did Warhammer Total War games and Halo Wars 2 and Age of Mythology. So that's the quick introduction. We're going to keep this as a shorter episode. So today we wanted to talk about why on earth RTS games are so expensive to make, with a special look at Stormgate as being more of the headline that many people have been discussing over the months. So what is our stance around this, and how can games be made perhaps more sustainably than Stormgate is doing? Obviously, they're high caliber, right? What's your thoughts on the caliber versus cost there, Brandon?
So I'd like to start with a recap of the situation. The other thing that I do is I've been writing about real-time strategy games and game design for 10 years now on waywardstrategy.com. And what I like to do in my articles is I start out by defining the situation so we're all kind of on the same page. And in this situation, the reason that this is so relevant right now is, was it last month or 2 months ago at this point? Stormgate released a post saying, hey, you know, we are funded through early access. We're launching into early access in order to start monetizing the game. And they, of course, did a Kickstarter. And then they did a, what was the other funding mechanism? They after Kickstarter, they had a historic Kickstarter. It was like $2.3 million or something.
They're selling
for inflation. It was the biggest video game Kickstarter I think to date.
Yeah. So after that, there was another one where you could register your interest to essentially get Frost Giant shares. But it's not a public offering. It's like registering your interest.
But it was a backer kit or something, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And I believe there's
yet another mechanism to further contribute, Kickstarter style, but not tied to goals, which I forget the name of that one, actually.
Right. So in response to that, there was a lot of conversation kicked off about like, hey, you know, we feel like Frost Giant. Sorry about that. Frost Giant wasn't being upfront about their financial situation and what they're doing with the money that they're asking people for. So what happened with the Kickstarter is they said, look, we're trying to give people physical rewards and we're using the Kickstarter to fund that. And then shortly thereafter, they said, okay, well, we're going to get additional money via these other mechanisms to continue funding development of the game. And a lot of people felt surprised or deceived even by Frost Giant because of the way they're asking for money and the way that they're apparently trying to get income from the game as soon as possible. So that's kind of kicked off this whole conversation about game funding. And one additional thing I do want to say is this is also part of a greater landscape of studio closings. Embracer has been closing studios and reducing studio sizes for several months now as well. And a lot of these things are financially related. So not just Frost Giant, but also there's been a lot of focus on the cost of games.
Yeah, we're talking about tens of thousands of people across the industry getting laid off or entire studios getting closed down. All major publishers are in some manner involved in that sort of behavior at the moment.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's not just Embracer, but there's a larger landscape of closures and cutbacks in the industry. So that's kind of brought this financial situation front and center, which is why we wanted to try to address the topic. Do you want to get started off and saying, like,
Sure.
what's going on? What's the situation with why games are so expensive and take so long to make, and
Well,
what's
I do have one more point to add to all the things you're saying. So the whole thing started with their initial behind the curtains funding of around 33 to 35 million. I don't remember exactly in US
Yeah, I
dollars.
think it was around 30, 35 million dollars, I believe.
So that's what they raised from all sorts of investors beforehand, before the whole thing was available for crowdfunding. So you gotta account for all these things. That's around a total amount of closing in on 40 million there. So it's a lot of moolah, right? For making a single game, especially for a startup studio. The other thing is, the reason people are specifically upset is not just because of the method of collecting money from fans, right? But also because they specifically stated that the current funding is sufficient until launch. But launch internally to Frost Giant means the early access launch, and they did not specify this on the Kickstarter and follow-up pages after that. And the follow-up pages is what really triggered everything. So now, all that aside, it's such a small mistake to make, right? To not say it's enough for early access to kick up. Such a small mistake, such big consequence in terms of the mood of the audience. Anyways, now, why are games so expensive? Well, I'm going to start with my argument that it doesn't necessarily need to be. We have certainly seen many other games that are similar in at least apparent quality, but made by much smaller teams. Like, even Godsorn can be brought up as an example of being just made by two people. That's an entire game made by two people. That's crazy. Obviously, it's not going to be on the scope of Frost Giant's game here. Stormgate is going to be significantly bigger. It's going to have a significantly more sophisticated technical background, right? With the engine essentially being Unreal Engine, but also a lot of their own technology is in there, which is probably not the case for Godsorn. There's going to be a significant amount of cinematics. There's lots of voice acting in the game with high profile people involved. So that's all expensive. But I'm going to point towards the main thing, which is having a physical office. That's expensive, whether you're renting or buying. Especially where they're located in Irvine, California, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really expensive area, and physical footprints with the associated costs of rents, leases, electricity, all that stuff. That definitely eats up cost. And of course, one of the bigger things that is always talked about but is also relevant here is salary.
Yes.
So that's a hugely significant factor in the cost of game development is developer salaries. So the more people you have, the more you're paying them per year. That adds up really fast. But I think what you said really sticks out to me is a lot of the stuff that is expensive for Stormgate is stuff that it's a little harder to for players to see and touch. So it might be obvious that Stormgate, they spent what, 2 solid years building their Frostplay engine on top of Unreal. In fact, recently, as of the recording of this, Stormgate released a video from GDC about their map making tools. And that's a huge technical investment that they've made to
Yes.
be able to ensure that people have access to a powerful, robust, useful tool set for developing maps and custom missions and stuff. And that's going to pay off hugely for them. And in fact, I think already that sort of thing is buying back some of the goodwill they burned with this confusion and around their current funding method, current funding levels. You know, being able to point to something and say, you know, this is what we're spending money on. I think that alone has a really big influence for them about, you know, around this whole conversation, because that's a huge technical effort that evidently took them, you know, a non-considerable amount of time to put together. But some of the other stuff, and I'm sorry, I don't want to just go on about this for too long.
No, please do. It is our topic, right?
The other thing that's really important to note is, you know, the whole tech stack for Stormgate, from top to bottom, that took a lot of time to get right. And I do think that's going to pay off for them. You know, pathfinding is immensely complex in a game like this. And it's, you know, it's something that really contributes to players wanting to stick around. You know, the units aren't doing things that I don't want them to do. They are doing what I want them to do when I want them to do it. You know, one issue we had with Tempest Rising in our demo is, you know, if you had a big group of units and you ordered them to move somewhere, sometimes a couple of them would just go walk about and they'd go halfway around the map trying to get to where they wanted to go. And if they felt like they were blocked, they would just go, you know, like flies. And that's something we have spent a considerable amount of time correcting, because controlling your units is so important. It's so critical to get that right. And, you know, Frost Giant is going to have an advantage over a lot of other RTS when it comes to just the feel of maneuvering physical objects in this space. That's hard to see, though, because you can see screenshots from Godsworn and you can see short gameplay clips and you can play, and Godsworn feels pretty good. But, you know, Frost Giant is really working really hard to make sure that's absolutely perfect.
Yeah, I mean, they have an absolutely insane technical background overall, but like their logical frame rate is super high as well. I believe it's over 60, isn't it? Did they actually make it 60?
I don't remember off the top of my head. I believe it is. It is higher than that.
But StarCraft II says like 21, I think. that's how smooth the game is.
Well, and I don't think, I think it's fair to say that no other RTS has that sort of response rate.
Absolutely.
That's something that they sat down at the very beginning and burned time and money to do. So that's what it comes down to, right? If we're going to try to take what we've said over the last, you know, 10 minutes and bring it back together, is they have these specialists sitting in California spending, you know, a year on tech without building any content. That's where the costs are going, right?
A big part of it, but I will say they have been very smart in terms of production. Like, you know, they obviously are very experienced developers leading this, and they didn't immediately get everyone on board. They ramped up production very gradually as they needed it. And only now-ish are they at the maximum size of their team that they want to do, plus outsourcing. So,
right, which is where we want to take this conversation, right, to extrapolate from, you know, what Stormgate is doing to how a game studio can be careful with their money. You know, inside, we know that you break down the production of a game into multiple phases, or the creation of a game into multiple phases. And during pre-production, when you're kind of figuring everything out, you don't need a team of, you know, 40 people or even 10 people.
Yeah.
And then, you know, as you get your technical fundamentals down, you know, then you can bring in designers and level designers, and then your artists. And what can be very costly for studios is paying for staff that aren't needed at a specific time. And there are studios that have the luxury of working on multiple projects. So, and that's the ideal situation, right? Is you have enough projects going on that you can have an artist go from project one to project two to project three as they're needed, and then go back and forth.
Yes, but as a startup, you're only going to have funding for your one project most of the time. And that is your entire, all your eggs are in that one basket. And the one advantage that you do have as a startup is you're not going to have that massive amount of staff. So you're going to handpick those vision holders that you're going to want to recruit at the beginning to decide together what the game is going to be with the leadership team, that is. And these vision holders can build out the plan while a technical team can make the fundamentals happen with just a bunch of boxes that you can control if necessary, just getting that technical frame rate going, getting the pathing going with boxes, right? That's a lot of what they have demonstrated as well very early on. And then you roll in the people that can create the content once you have these very fundamentals figured out. So that can save a lot of money. But even then, it's expensive because, well, California.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's an expensive place to set up shop. And clearly they thought that it was worthwhile, but I think there are, I think one reason you see European studios have smaller success and still stick around is because they've got very different cost of living considerations in places like, you know, Denmark and Norway and Germany. For a lot of the time, it's a very different dynamic.
I will say not in the big cities.
I mean, absolutely, if you're in a large city.
But if you can be a remote worker or even a hybrid worker, and let's say you don't need to build the infrastructure in your office for every single person. Some of them can be home permanently, right? And just geared up there. That is so much cheaper to get to function like that. So you have to think about, essentially, in the UK at least, London area, right? You're going to want to calculate, converted into dollars, like almost $15,000 every year per developer to locate them into an office. And that's not even covering their benefits and their salary and whatever other random stuff comes up.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely also someone that sings the praises of remote work. You know, I've been remote working on Tempest Rising for 4 years now. I feel like Discord and Google Meet, you know, that covers a lot of, you know, getting in touch with people and, you know, communicating back and forth and, you know, even, you know, comments in Confluence or something.
Sure.
Is a great way to get a back and forth going.
For the layman, Confluence is our documentation software that pretty much every developer uses these days. You just put up your wiki and people can make quick comments, edit simultaneously. It's like Google Drive, basically, for devs.
Yeah. And there's a free version called Notion, or it's a similar product that's free called Notion. I don't know if it has as much collaboration. I've used it before, but I don't.
Yeah.
It's been a while. But Notion's a really good piece of software if you're looking to create documentation around a game and you're a smaller project. But like you said, you know, Google Docs is also just a good way. We end up doing a lot of stuff in Google Docs. Because what we do is Confluence is like authoritative. We don't want to put anything in there unless it's ready to be worked on.
It's so much more sophisticated than Google Docs would be, or the entire Drive suite, really.
Yeah, absolutely. But you can do similar things in Google Docs, and we use it as well for drafting. And then we get the final version into Confluence for implementation. But there are a lot of free tools out there for smaller teams.
Of course, all these software
comparable things.
All these software packages, they also do bear some not insignificant cost, but it's pretty minor when it comes to comparing that versus the developers. So, like, let's say
right. I mean, you're probably hitting the cost of, you know, a couple of one or two developers with all the software you're going to be using. Okay, so let's try to wrap this up and summarize this and bring this back to context, because we started out this conversation saying, you know, Stormgate and Frost Giant have kind of put this whole thing into focus. You know, it's brought a lot of this conversation about, you know, what studios are spending money on and how much money it costs. And it's very easy to look at what Frost Giant did critically. But I think in the middle of the conversation, we started bringing it back around to like, what's going on with them is understandable given, you know, the parameters they're working under and the quality of the product they're trying to produce. And that being, even if, you know, you can look at something like Godsworn, and it's so incredibly wild that was made just by some people, because it's such a beautiful game, and it's smartly put together. And
yes,
but I think the big thing we need to say is, you know, the scope of something like Stormgate is very different.
Yeah, you absolutely must understand paying nearly $100,000 per developer for 5 years is kind of going to empty the coffers. Not gonna lie, that's kind of how it is. Now, why are they doing it like this, though? Let's talk about the benefits of actually being in the same office. You know, if you can just walk up to the person next to you and say, "Come over, take a look at my screen. I'm going to show you something. What do you think?" That alone is such a productive little piece of interaction that you just don't get from remote working very easily, because you have to drag them into a Zoom call or whatever software you're using. And it's just not the same, because you don't get to overhear things, right? So when I am showing you something versus our other colleague overhears it, and then, ooh, can I also take a look? And then you suddenly have an impromptu little collaboration going. That's a very important piece of developer culture that just leads to better results over time. But if you manage your team very well remotely, you can still get these engagements going, but it has to be on purpose, and it's almost never spontaneous.
Yes, that being said, a good leadership structure for the team definitely does help. Mm-hmm. You know, having team leads have regular meetings, encouraging people to jump into a Discord stream while they're doing something, to work through things, especially with artists, you know, collaborating, or level designers and environment artists being able to collaborate in real time. So you can foster that sort of kind of casual contact using something like Discord or Teams or other tools like that. You just have to make the conscious effort to do that, where it's a little easier to happen organically if you're walking around an office. And it's very frustrating for people if like 90% of the studio is in the office and you've got like a handful of people that are trying to contribute remotely. I've been in that situation before as well, where you know, I was on a 5-person team and I was the only person that wasn't sitting in the office. It was a really hard experience, because we were in meetings, mm-hmm. and they're all talking to each other, and I'm just, you know, it's all distant and echoey, and because it's one of those little portable conference speakers. It's really tough if most of the staff is not remote, and you've only got a couple of workers that are remote. If most people are remote, it actually becomes a lot more easy for everyone to get together and collaborate.
Yes. Another huge benefit for Frost Giant is that they're right next to Blizzard, and so they can nick some people.
Absolutely. I think that's a big advantage to them, because they want a physical office and they want all the people there collaborating, being where a lot of the talent is, even though it's expensive, is important for them.
Yeah, like a lot of people no doubt will have settled down in the area. So the commute or lack of commute would be very easy for that crew. Much less so if you're trying to move there from another state or even outside of the country.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know much about people they've brought on and how they've, you know, integrated them. It would be interesting to see it like a post-mortem or something, like how they work with, if they have people that are contributing remotely, how they work with them.
Okay, I think we might be reaching the end of this topic. Do you think you agree? Do you have any further points to add here?
No, so we talked about FrostGiant's situation specifically. I think we covered the ups and the downs of that. We tried to broaden it out to the industry in general, and tried to share some thoughts with other development teams about, you know, how they can work together remotely and, you know, kind of the pros and cons of working in person versus remote. I think that pretty much sums up the whole topic. If we wanted to do one last thing, we might want to talk about like what we see in other studios and about how they might have approached these same topics with you know, remote work and funding and budget. It's hard to get information about that unless you work for the studio and then you're probably under an NDA. But that would be the last thing I could think of if we were going to cover anything else.
Yeah, very much so. So there is this new precedence of these relatively experienced teams coming together and then still doing the community style Kickstarter, right? The guys at Zero Space are doing this. Even Homeworld Free has done it, right? Even though that's a much bigger thing with Gearbox and whatever at the helm of the business side of things. So I think if you can put together a product and have the ability to market it correctly, I think kickstarting or using some similar fundraiser is totally viable. You know, even if you're shooting for some lower values, you're going to find an audience for it within the RTS niche. Just have to be realistic, scope your team accordingly, scope your project accordingly.
And one of the biggest things with Kickstarter is you have to be at a point where you can meaningfully show off the unique aspects of the game.
Yes.
And you have to be very clear. Like, the more clear you can be about where the money is going and what it's for, the better. Like, the more detailed your financial situation is, the more competent you look to the average consumer, and the more safe you feel when people are thinking about giving their money to your project. You know, if a studio doesn't have a good breakdown of how they're going to use this money, it makes it seem like either they don't know or they don't want to say, and either of those things can have a real impact on confidence.
Yeah, it's kind of like in the distant past having to not quite deliver a demo, but like, you're basically pitching to investors, right? Except they're community supporters on Kickstarter. So you're going to want some sort of vertical slice that you can present to people. Now, vertical slice meaning that it's got a little bit of several parts of the game featured in it. So you can take a look and get a rough idea of what the game is about, and you can describe the rest. You're not going to need to absolutely implement everything and have like a full campaign or whatever, but a little bit of a demonstration of what your game can do is very important, as you say.
Absolutely. Showing some sort of substantial technical progress of like, this is stuff moving around in the game. That is important, but I mean, for better or worse, also having it look attractive. And it's tough because when you're developing a game from the beginning, art is usually one of the last things you want to do because it's so hard to change once it's in. But for projects like Stormgate and Zero Space, one of the reasons they did so well, you know, for Stormgate, obviously the names of the people and the pedigree was a big part of it, but also being able to show off like, here's finalized content in motion. You know, here we're doing a tournament during the Kickstarter. You know, that's not everyone's going to be able to do that, but being able to show the stuff that looks like it's in a final product, that certainly does help. But having some degree of confidence that your team has the technical skills to actually finish the thing is also really important. And I think that's something else that Immortal Gates of Pyre did pretty well, showing off visuals and a vision.
Yeah, you know, honestly, taking these games as an example of how to do it, you just look at how much they communicate and the quality of the communication and what message they're trying to convey. I think they make for a really good case study if anybody is looking to set up something similar.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I think that's a pretty comprehensive look. I can't think of anything else we could add to the discussion, but I feel like we've pretty much gone full circle on that.
Yeah. So yeah, for the smaller teams, I'll definitely be an advocate for remote work. You know, you're gonna need every little penny you can save to actually ship your project and make it good. So buying up a studio or having expensive rent probably not in your interest, but you can still pull everything off and learn from these big names about how to fundraise. If
yeah,
you're
absolutely
more powerful, then you can probably copy these formats, however, quite directly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then I think we will call it there. Everyone can follow us on all the different podcast platforms. We're also on YouTube, posting this as a video. So thanks for listening and watching, or both of them together even. That's crazy. We also have a Patreon.
We're hoping with a shorter format, we can commit to getting these out more regularly as well, because it's something we both love doing and talking with each other and sharing this with you guys. And, you know, the reality is we both have so much going on. We feel like we're drowning, you know, burning the candle at both ends. But being able to find time to do this is really fun for us. So,
yeah, we might be busy, but we're trying. We're trying to make this happen. So we'll be here for the next one. See everyone soon. Bye bye.
Looking forward to it. Bye.